Chapter 9. They tarried back at Kerguelen for a week, with Sire Kay lecturing them on the finer points of chivalry, while they helped them with the work of getting new hives ready for the bees and filtering last year's honey. But then they left again, this time for a stay at Chepstone Castle, where Sire Kay paid a call on his liege, Baron Arathaniel. He had much to report to the old baron in private concerning his journey into Sashtalia. Tyndall considered using the long ears spell to overhear their counsel, but Chepstone Castle's fair ladies kept him too distracted for such a blatant violation of his trust. The boys had both met the distinguished baron several times, but had rarely had the opportunity to speak with him alone. But when Sire Kay asked his leave to impart some of his wisdom on the art of chivalry on the boys, the man was eager for the chance. He spared much of the day for them, allowing them to accompany him as he toured one of his outlying estates for a surprise inspection. The knight in charge of the manor was pleased to be able to show off for his overlord, and provided as delightful a feast as his holding could command that evening. If being an errant was a ticket to regular meals, Tyndall observed, the upper nobility were even more richly treated. Of course, since it was Arathaniel's estate, it was technically his own food he was eating, he reasoned. "That is interesting news about the snowstone," Arathaniel agreed at table, after Sire Kay informed him of the illicit mine. "Twice so that Sashtalia does not know what he owns in it. Yet it is only a matter of time before he does realize it, and seeks to put a guard on it," Sire Kay pointed out. "That is not insurmountable," the Baron demurred as he worked his way through a bowl of beans and salt pork. What makes it difficult is how many leagues lie between Tarraguen and Sendari lands. Not so many between Tarraguen and Sevendor, Rondal pointed out. Merely a 3,000-foot ridge. That may be more insurmountable, grunted the Baron. What is this snowstone worth, do you think? Its weight in silver, at least, Rondal said, just before Tyndall could say the same thing. Perhaps as much as gold, once its full capabilities are realized. I would not have my rival keep access to a mountain of gold in his domain, pronounced Arathaniel. Nor silver. Currently I have the upper hand in lances, thanks to last year's conquests. Even with the loss of the men in Gilmora, I have edged out that pretender. But should he suddenly be able to hire mercenaries in large quantities? I see your point, Excellency, agreed Sire Kay. I will confer with the spellmonger and see what can be done about this, before Sashtalia realizes what it has. Sire Kay took the opportunity that evening to tutor the boys in how to properly serve their betters at table, among other tasks. It is an honor for a knight to be asked to serve his liege at the board, Kay instructed them. It is both a sign of humility and a sign of pride that you would submit so graciously to your master. Even counts see it as an honor to serve a duke his dinner. Baron Arathaniel indulgently welcomed the lessons, offering his own opinion and perspective of their service. It was not difficult, Tyndall quickly realized, but there were certain rules you had to follow, lest you accidentally slop soup on someone who could send you to the battlefield some day. On the ride back to Chepstone the next morning, the Baron continued to expound on chivalry. You must always endeavor to treat your inferiors as equals, your equals as superiors, and your superiors as beyond reproach. What if your superiors are unworthy, Excellency? Asked Rondal. They often are, but that does not mean they are not superiors. Honorable service is honorable service. It matters not, in most cases, to whom it is rendered. Why would a good knight serve an unworthy master? Tyndall asked. Excellency, he added belatedly, when Sire Kay caught his eye. Any number of reasons, shrugged the Baron. Heredity among them. Oft a knight inherits a liege from his father. Men die and produce heirs. Agreements made between two men in one generation may lose their value in the next, as situations change. That does not lift the burden of such agreements, however, and an honorable knight will see them through to the letter, if need be. And a less than honorable knight? Tyndall asked. If a man finds his honour challenged by such agreements, suggested the Baron thoughtfully, then he is often intelligent enough to discover an honourable way out of it. Appeals to the gods, for instance, or a competing agreement. A wise knight seeks not to place himself in such straits to begin with. While at Chepstow Castle, they spent a day with the squires at practice in the yard. Many were near their own age, near to winning their spurs themselves. In a way, Tyndall envied them. They were learning the trade by the more tedious route than he, but the expectations of them were lower. They were still struggling with letters and estate management, for instance, but they were already adept horsemen. Seeing what a squire had to endure to win his spurs was instructive, Tyndall found. Running laps around the castle in a full mail hauberk, for example, or bearing a shield while your comrades rammed logs into it to toughen you, seemed unnecessarily brutal. After consideration, Tyndall decided he much preferred the honored-on-the-battlefield path to knighthood. At Chepstow, they focused on horsemanship. Tyndall knew plenty of horseflesh, as any former stable boy does. He was even a passable rider, compared to Rondall. But when it came to the art of fighting from horseback and controlling an animal in a chaotic situation on a battlefield, he discovered he knew far less than he thought. The old knight, who was Chepstow's master of horse, charged with overseeing their horsemanship, was replete with criticism for his riding, and some of it was even constructive. At last, he was at ease with horses. Rondall seemed perpetually nervous around the animals. The horse master had to speak with him repeatedly in hushed conferences, no doubt unpleasant affairs. As bad as it was being called a sack of potatoes for how he rode, he could only imagine the vitriol reserved for such discussions that Rondall endured. He had to admit his rival's riding improved significantly afterward, so he couldn't fault their utility. But then there was tilting, something he was extremely intrigued by. He took a few turns at jousting himself, and while he did a passable job at the quoits, when it came to running a perfectly good horse into another perfectly good horse, he found he lacked enough basic skill in the matter to find himself painfully thrown from his mount thrice. Rondall, he was gratified to see, had even less skill at the art. They both fared better at swordplay from horseback, employing their mage blades as skillfully in a charge as the squires were able to. Both of them neatly sliced the targets on either side of their mounts in the drill, once they got the trick of balancing in the stirrups for leverage. With magical augmentation, they were particularly effective, though there was little they could do to extend their spells to their mounts. That was brown magic, and they knew very little of it. What Tyndall enjoyed most about Chepstow wasn't the list field, however. It was the bounty of young ladies within its walls. Baronial castles were big, drafty, uncomfortable places for the most part, but they were also secure. More, they served in peacetime as centres of social activity, where the mid-level nobility served and courted the baron's household. It was also a popular place to send younger daughters or sisters to the baron's castle for safekeeping, as the baron's wards. That such associations with the squires and young knights of the land often led to beneficial matches was also well known, and most noble families sought to send their daughters to the castle for the refinement of society. Chepstow had a large crop of these, more so when you added in the students at the nearby temple to Trigg, where noble daughters were taught their letters and the arts until they were married off, apprenticed to trade, or took holy orders. There were over 24 young noble women at Chepstow, and each one of them seemed eager to make his acquaintance. Teaching the boys the rudiments of courtly dance provided plenty of opportunity for discourse and flirtation, and the midsummer feast allowed them an opportunity to practice with the gaggle of giggling maidens. Tyndall was studying more than pavans and courtly manners, however. Tyndall was studying the maidens. Tyndall found it an ideal opportunity to hone his knowledge of the 16 laws of love and their application. He was careful never to engage any one maiden overmuch, as the laws bid. At a feast of femininity as lush as Chepstow, he was content to indulge his appetites within the bounds of propriety, and twice just outside those bounds. But the maidens of Chepstow were hardly a challenge. He even caught Rondall kissing a girl once. When it was time to leave, he was grateful. A few of the maids had started to get territorial. Sire Kay led them back to Car Gwenyn by a circuitous route, and Tyndall could tell the Dragon Slayer was searching for something in particular, though he would give little clue what it might be. Instead of the direct route, they traversed the domains of Grendor and Tarasil, prosperous lands with tidy, well-kept riverlands villages and neatly laid-out fields sprouting wheat, rye, oats, and maize. But then they entered a dark and twisted wood. the forest known as Harris Grove, for the bands of thieves who are purported to haunt it.
That sounds to me like you chose this route a purpose, Rundle observed, a little anxiously.
At the request of the Baron, actually, corrected Sire Kay. He invited me to tour the domain of Lormyr. This grove marks its frontier with Tarrasil.
And why should we tour the domain of Lormyr? Asked Tyndall suspiciously, particularly when it lies on the other side of a wood so ominously named.
Do you fear a name, Sir Tyndall? Asked Sire Kay with a chuckle.
It is but a name, he agreed, and I fear neither thief nor wood. But still, it seems imprudent, he pronounced, bringing his horse to a halt.
From time to time a lord may wish to investigate a matter in his lands, but knows that an official inquiry may not be the best way to discover the truth of the matter. So he asks the gentlemen of his court to quietly look into it, without troubling the lord overmuch with their inspection.
He has his vassals spy upon each other, answered Rundle sourly.
He uses the resources at his disposal to ensure accountability, corrected Sire Kay. He has a responsibility to the people of his barony, and depending on officials who can be bribed and corrupted is not necessarily the best way to safeguard their security. Lormyr is ruled by one Lord Galenulan, whose line has been loyal Lensley vassals for 300 years.
But there is a problem now, Tyndall guessed.
It has reached the Baron's ears that Lord Galenulan has been lax on his response to the banner call last autumn, informing Baron Arathaniel that he could supply but 12 lances, when his lands should be able to produce more than 40. He sent only 6, and they did not volunteer for duty in Gilmora.
So Lord Galenulan is holding out for some reason, supplied Rundle.
I am to discover the reason for the deficit, Sire Kay answered. It is possible that there are many good, reasonable reasons for it. I am to determine what those are, preferably without alerting Lord Galenulan as to my purpose.
Our purpose, he amended.
And to what could such a deficiency be blamed upon, Sire Kay? Rundle asked thoughtfully.
Any number of legitimate reasons, reasoned the older knight, as he nudged his horse forward. Plague and poverty are the usual reasons cited. Anything less than that is not usually taken seriously as a reason by your liege. That doesn't mean he can necessarily do anything about it. But if he's conspiring somehow, or merely wishes to avoid the expense, well, a good overlord seeks to know these things. The village of Lentry was on the outskirts of Lormyr, but as it lay on the southern road through the barony, it was a large village. At least 1,000 souls called Lentry home, and if there was sickness or poverty there, there was no sign that Tyndall could see. The peasants looked happy, or at least not miserable, as they chopped at the weeds around the furrows of wheat and beans, or listlessly worked at mowing the meadows. The village was large enough to boast 2 inns, a tavern, a blacksmith, a barber, and a twice-a-week market. A brightly painted green shrine to Trigg Allmother was popular, he noted. But there seemed no overt reason why the men carrying hoes between fields could not just as easily have carried spears in Gilmora last year.
Interesting, murmured Sire Kay as they rode to the tavern's rail.
I don't see anything out of the ordinary, declared Rondal.
That is precisely what is interesting, agreed Sire Kay. Perhaps a pint or two to clear the road dust from your throats, gentlemen.
As they were tying off their horses and Sire Kay paid a boy a penny to watch them, the older knight made a point of whispering to both of his charges.
Say little, and listen much, he counselled. A casual word in a public house can oft tell the wise man volumes. If questioned, we're 3 knights on the way back from Sendaria to our estates in the south. Say little more, if you are able.
Tyndall reached out, mind to mind, to Rundle as they entered the tavern.
Do you find this at all like spying? This is precisely like spying,
Rundle answered.
Well, isn't that unchivalrous?
You'd have to ask Sire Kay, but, well, considering that a knight's first duty is to his liege, in particular the rendering of military service, and reconnaissance lies within that field, then from his perspective he is just performing honourable service, and it is a liege's duty to police his vassals. So, it might be technically unchivalrous, but in the grander scheme of things...
Wow! She's pretty.
Tyndall quickly turned around and saw who Rundle had spotted.
a young woman, only a few years older than them both, was sitting in the company of two much older women, all wearing travelling cloaks. She was indeed quite pretty under her wimple, an angular face, high cheekbones, and striking brown eyes. Her hair was dark under the headcloth, braided into two neat plaits. From her clothing and her jewellery she was decidedly not a peasant. The pewter rings in her hair were well made, the sort of thing a burgher's daughter might wear. The women were deep in conversation, each nursing an earthenware mug of ale, three empty dishes of stew on the table in front of them, a few crusts of bread, the only thing left of their lunch.
"Too bad she's headed for an abbey," Tyndall replied,
"and not a fun goddess like Ishi from the severe look of those two guard dogs," Rondell agreed. While not every order required celibacy for its clergy, most discouraged such things as distractions from devotion at best. More than likely the maiden was looking forward to a few long, lonely years in meditation and contemplation.
"Such a waste," Tyndall sighed.
Sire Kay led them past the women, and Tyndall was gratified when the pretty one looked up and caught his glance. He gave her a friendly smile. She looked away just as quickly. That wasn't a bad sign, Tyndall had learned. In fact, it could be a good sign. "Three ales," the knight ordered from the portly barman, who filled up three more cups from a huge jug he carried on his shoulder and passed them over when Sire Kay pushed him a few pennies. "What village might this be, master?" he asked conversationally.
"That would be the village of Lentry, chief settlement of the domain of Lomir, gentlemen," the man said, a little loudly. "By your cloaks, your gentry. What brings you to our fair little hamlet?" "Just passing through from Sindaria," Sire Kay admitted, handing the ales to Rondell and Tyndall. "On our way to inspect an estate. Tell me, what tolls lie on the road ahead?"
"Southward, you should bear east first, and avoid Darnevron. That's the domain of Cyrus Gellert, a harsh and cruel banneret. Lordly folk like yourself will suffer a silver penny each to cross his lands," he predicted.
"A silver penny?" Tyndall burst out. "That's an excellent way to raise revenue," Sire Kay finished. "Has this knight banneret found other ways to line his purse at your expense?" It seemed an innocent enough question, and Tyndall did not expect such a profound reaction. But the barman immediately began complaining bitterly.
"By Trigg's holy womb he has," the proprietor said,
setting his jug down on a table with a thud.
"He purchased the estate of Rena's Run, near to the river, and then had the stones to levy a tax on every fish taken from it on either side of the stream. When the good folk of Lormir have fished there at the Lord's sufferance without fee for generations, there's many a cottager who would have no flesh at all if they did not take fish from the stream."
"And what has your lord done about this?" Sire Kay asked, sipping the ale appreciatively.
"Surely he is not standing for such an imposition on his realm?"
"I cannot say," the barman said, suddenly realizing he may have been talking too much. He looked around guiltily.
"But you might notice cheese is a bit expensive in the market," he muttered.
"I see," Sire Kay said, smiling quietly. "Good luck to you then, my friend. Have one for yourself," he said, pushing a third penny to the man.
"Trigg's blessing on you, my lord," the barman said, beaming. "I'm feeling thirsty, now that you mention it."
As he bustled off to pour himself an ale, Sire Kay took a seat with the two young knights and nodded, satisfied.
"There you have it, gentlemen, the answer to our question, and it took but three copper pennies and the right questions."
"Oh, what do you mean?
I heard a man complaining about fish and the price of cheese," Tyndall pointed out.
"Sir Rondell, any other insights?"
"The folk of Lormir don't like the Lord of Darnevron," he decided, "and the banneret is feeling in an expansive mood."
"What is a banneret?"
asked Tyndall, a bit embarrassed for his ignorance.
"A kind of senior knight," Sire Kay answered. "It is not a title used much in the Wilderlands, but is more common in the Riverlands. A banneret traditionally can raise 24 lances, and usually has 2 or 3 domains as vassals. A bit above a sire, a bit below a baron. A banneret knight is oft looked to by his peers for advice, counsel, and wisdom."
"Only this one seems to want to encroach on his neighbour's territory," Rondell pointed out, "increasing revenues, putting pressure on the population."
"Ah, now I see why cheese was the key."
"Exactly,"
nodded Sire Kay.
Exactly what?
Tyndall asked. What has cheese to do with anything? If a lord suspects that the crops of his folk will be disturbed, or that there may be a siege in the future, one of the first things he does is start buying cheese, Rondell answered, authoritatively. High protein, high fat, and it keeps for months and months. Cheese, ham, bacon, eggs, sausage, any food that can be put in stores usually rises in price directly before hostilities, he finished, proudly. Next will be grain, and then vegetables and fodder. But cheese takes time, so you start buying it up as soon as you think there might be war. So, the Lord of Lormyr is anticipating a war with this knight Banneret, reasoned Tyndall. Which explains why he sent only a token force to the banner call, agreed Sire Kay. It is not uncommon for an aggressive lord to use such an occasion to infringe on a neighbour's unguarded territory, raiding the henhouse while the dog is hunting, so to speak. But aren't both of them vassals of the Baron? Asked Rondell. They are, Sire Kay agreed. But a wise lord is careful not to interfere over much in the affairs of his vassals. From the Baron's perspective, this is a contest to see who is stronger. Regardless of how it plays out, he will have the strongest lord in command of these lands. But what about justice? Tyndall asked, concerned. Is it not a liege's duty to ensure justice among his vassals? If the Banneret proceeds with his encroachment, it may well become such a matter, acknowledged Sire Kay. But if the Lord of Lormyr goes to Arathaniel with a petty matter, it will be a sign of his weakness. A lord who cannot defend his territory without recourse to law, brothers, is weak. But how does it serve the Baron to have two of his men spend their lives of their troops on each other? Rondell prompted. Again, it is a matter of scale. If war does break out, there will be an attempt to negotiate between the two under the auspices of the clergy or of their mutual liege, such as there was between Westphalia and Sevendor, he reminded them. But such contests rarely go that route. It is usually a matter of a few weeks' skirmishes and raids, then a parley. In this case, I foresee that Lormyr will begin pushing back against these fees. Some warden may find himself on the wrong side of the stream, for instance, and be sent back to Dunevron in chains. Or a few discouraging arrows from guards on this side of the bank will begin the feud. A wise knight should always be wary of such skirmishes, however, he added, for they can quickly become more involved, as emotions run high and retribution is demanded. So you're just going to report that there's about to be a war in southern Sindaria, reasoned Rondell, even though you don't think the Baron will do anything about it. That was the extent of my commission, Sire Kay said, finishing his ale. I will ask a few other questions, listen to a few other conversations, but I think our assessment of events is clear enough. A contest amongst vassals. Nothing more. Tyndall looked around. It might be more to these folk, he said quietly. In truth, nodded Sire Kay gravely, they will be the ones to suffer most while their lords argue. Thus should every good lord understand the gravity with which he makes war. It is the curse of our time that rash words and bellicose attitudes lead to suffering and devastation of the innocent. So, how would you handle such a neighbour, if someone was encroaching on your domain like that? Sire Kay considered. In this case, I would challenge the man to single combat. As a knight banneret, leading other knights by example, he would be honour-bound to answer such a challenge under most situations. If a man is willing to put an army in the field to achieve his objectives, he should be willing to face danger himself, and that would force him to choose his course. But I am not the lord of this land, and this is not my fight. My duty is to my liege. Now that I understand the situation better, I should report back to him of what I have found. Rondell groaned. So we're headed back to Chepstow Castle. Nay, Sire Kay said with a small grin, I shall return to Chepstow alone. You, gentlemen, I gift with a commission. As part of your errantry, I ask that you attempt to collect a debt on my behalf. Or on behalf of my domain, I should say. Is chivalry to be used in such a manner? Tyndall asked, nostrils flaring. I thought law brothers and paid collectors did such work. And should the matter descend to that, agreed Sire Kay, then those will be the avenues of approach I shall take. But the situation is thus.
Long before I won Carguenion, the estate had several outstanding payments for honey and wax, which were made in good faith, but, alas, have not been paid by other estates. Before I became its lord, Carguenion had to depend on the good faith of those estates, and Lady Estret did what she could to collect, through messages and letters requesting payment. Since I have come into power, many of those have suddenly been paid. It is one thing when your creditor is a sweet noblewoman. It is another when it is a man who is called Dragon Slayer. Both boys laughed at that, appreciating the humour. But there are two estates with large balances that have resisted Lady Estret's best efforts to collect. As it happens, both lie nearby, the estates of Raymoth's Wood and Loughhorn Manor, which lie in the next domain south, Durandor. So you want us to go shake down these debtors? Rondel asked. I would put it more delicately, Sire Kay said. I merely wish for you two gentlemen to pay a call to the estates, speak with their castellans or reeves, and remind them of their debt and the honour of paying it promptly and in full. If you find extenuating circumstances, then I trust you to contend with them chivalrously. And you needn't hold the folk at sword point. We are not bandits, he reminded them sternly. But a personal visit from my armed representatives, especially two such formidable young knights, could well speed payment. And while I am not suffering, he smiled, he was well paid by their master for his service as Sevendor's castellan, and had received gifts from duke and king for his valour. I find such outstanding balances untidy. A man who cannot collect his debts displays his weakness as much as when he allows his walls to fall into disrepair. Note that I would be open to trade, as much as coin, he added. I just wish these matters to be gone from my accounts. It still seems unknightly, grumbled Tyndall. Knights were supposed to be fighting or dancing, or off being brave against unfair odds or such. Acting as a collection agent just didn't seem to fit the vocation. Faithfully executing the instructions of your liege in the running of his estate is honourable service, Sire Cade disagreed. Nothing could be more chivalrous than a knight performing his duty. Remember, we are not merely military officers. We hold a social rank as well, and most aspire to commercial success to the extent that we can perform our duties and support our horses and arms properly. Being open-handed and generous is a sign of grace in a gentleman. Allowing his estate to be cheated out of fairly owed debt is not chivalrous. It is a sign of weakness. But would you have us draw swords over a 50 weight of honey? Rondel asked in disbelief. You need not draw swords at all, Sire Kay explained. Just appear. Introduce yourselves as emissaries of the House of Carguenion, and bring the debt to their attention. Somehow I doubt they are willing to draw swords over 50 weight of honey either. But, in truth, I know not the names or characters of the debtors in the slightest, merely the names and amounts and dates of their purchases and deliveries. He stood, after handing a sheet of parchment to Rondal containing the specifics of the accounts. Is that within your capabilities, gentlemen? He challenged. Of course, Sire Kay, Tyndall said, rising and bowing. Rondal followed suit. It would be our honour to hound your debtors on your behalf. And we shall endeavour to be a credit to your estate, added Rondal. Of course, we know not the way, nor do we have the resources to make an extended journey, he mentioned, expectedly. Ah, Sire Kay said philosophically, life is replete with such challenges, and the brave errant accepts them gladly as an opportunity to demonstrate his resourcefulness. You have been given your charge, gentlemen. I look forward to hearing of your adventures in a week's time, in my hall at Carguenion. But do not tarry. I know your master has a much more important errand on your horizon, and I would not have you be late. So, you want us to go forth without a penny? Tyndall asked, mentally calculating the weight of his own purse. Of course not, Sire Kay said, tossing a very small, purse on the table. There must be at least 9, 10 copper pennies in there, and perhaps a few silver bits as well. I trust in your ability to use it wisely, or add to it, as you see fit. A pouch of copper? Tyndall asked in disbelief. We
"'Gratefully accept your assistance and will be steadfast in completing our commission,' Sire Kay. Rondal finished smoothly, after quietly kicking Tyndall's shins enough to interrupt him. Sire Kay nodded. "'Good luck, then, gentlemen.' And without another word he left.
"'Why in four hells did you do that?'
complained Tyndall. Not that the kick had hurt, but he resented being interrupted like that.
"'For your own good, idiot.'
Rondal murmured as they watched the Dragonslayer mount his horse through the window. I learned back at the Mysteries that complaints about resources usually led to a reduction in resources. He gave us all he was going to give us. That's part of the exercise. It sounds more like an excuse to get some free service done on his behalf. Now you're starting to understand the glorious subtleties of feudalism, Rondal said sarcastically, motioning to the barman for two more pints. And I have considerably more than that in my pouch if we need it. Tyndall remembered he, too, had a half-dozen silver pennies in his pocket, the remains of what Master Minolin had given them, but he still resented being used like a common bill collector. Rondal saw his discomfort. This is a test, Sir Haystack. It matters less if we actually secure payment and more how we conduct ourselves. We've just been handed our first solo errand. But there are two of us, Tyndall pointed out. Rondal looked at him like he was an idiot.
Oh,
Tyndall realized. I see what you are saying. First errand without adult supervision.
Right,
Rondal agreed as the barman brought two more rounds. And it's a simple task, like building a bridge was, he groaned. But it's one that's unlikely to result in bloodshed. Sure, we won't be staying at the finest inns. But this is rural Sendaria. There aren't any fine inns, and that other place is in rural Sashtalia. So we're going to be begging room and board from manors the whole way. That's what this is about. Errantry. Tyndall sipped his ale and thought about what his fellow apprentice said. Sometimes he felt utterly intimidated by Rondal's keen insights and quick wits. Tyndall wasn't stupid, not by any measure. But sometimes it took him longer to recognize important details and realize what seemed to spring to Rondal's mind naturally. It was easily one of Rondal's more annoying traits.
All right,
he said with a sigh. We'll go do this trial. I suppose a little light errantry is good practice. Besides, he said cagily, just about all of those manors have dewy-eyed maidens who like the look of a brave young knight. And I do so enjoy meeting new people, he decided.
That's whatever keeps you motivated,
Rondal said, sighing with resignation. Tyndall watched the young woman and her two older companions get up, pay the shot, and leave, making the room a bit quieter, if less fair. He watched her go and saw her glance over her shoulder at him. He smiled. She blushed. She left. It felt odd taking their ease in the afternoon with a pint without a lesson, lecture, or exercise threatening them, he realized. He forced himself to relax. This was the first time in a long time that he'd been left to his own devices, more or less. Only now he was saddled with Rondal, who was sure to keep this outing from being as much fun as it could be. That wasn't completely fair, he chided himself. Rondal had come a long way in a short time, and was far from the insufferable snot he'd been last year. Tyndall looked over to his fellow apprentice, and noted that he wasn't even the scrawny bookworm he'd been at Yule. The Mysteries and the Grace of the Gods had filled out Rondal impressively. He was still of smaller stature than Tyndall, but his shoulders and arms seemed to have doubled in size, and instead of being hesitant when he walked, he strode with confidence now. Unless there was a girl around. Rondal realized he was being stared at.
"'So what do you think about all of this chivalry stuff?'
Tyndall asked, a little awkwardly, to deflect the attention.
"'How do you mean?'
Rondal replied cautiously, as they finished their ales and left money on the table. Whichever direction they were headed, if they did not get on the road soon, it would be dark before they got there.
"'I mean, it has some benefits, I can see, but does it have to be this demanding?
Well, every profession has its tough parts.' Rondal said as he untied his mount.
I feel as if I've been put through a millwork,
Tyndall admitted to his rival, despite himself, as they mounted their horses. In Arion, Raylan Kor, now this errantry. Forget the metaphors. I really do feel like I've been beaten betwixt hammer and anvil.
Me too,
agreed Rondel as he turned his horse southward. "And you didn't have to endure the mysteries. But why the sudden concern? I thought you liked being a knight."
Tyndall watched the young maiden and her two escorts start down the road in a light carriage pulled by a pair of rounces. She barely acknowledged him as she rode by. Tyndall tried to imagine a different outcome of their chanced meeting, one in which she was desperate for one last moment of passion before she was cloistered in whichever abbey or temple she was destined for. It was a pleasant distraction to the talk of hammers and anvils. Since Yule, there haven't been many days that weren't crammed full of learning something vitally important about which our fate, and perhaps all of Calador's, might some day depend. I know we're lucky to be where we are, but Ishi's itching twat. I feel like I've been pushed around and told what to do for so long. Well, I guess I was just wondering if I was just feeling sorry for myself, if the gods do seem to be kicking our asses daily.
I'd favour the divine in that debate, Rondel agreed with a sigh. He still rode like a sack of meal, despite some improvement, but he was far more confident in the saddle.
Ever since, well, Yule, but especially ever since Inarion, I felt like my life was one long tragically comedic epic. Like being sent home through country you've never heard of without a guide, on a mission of vague importance, and being judged by doing only knows what standards by our masters,
Tyndall snorted.
The tale would be worth a drink, at any rate. But I was asking, I suppose, what do you think of all this knight's magi business?
You're reconsidering your profession? Asked Rondel, surprised. Seems a little late for that now.
No, Tyndall said with a snort. I've got ambition, and the gods have given me a worthy path. But all of these rules, all of these expectations about a job no one has really had before.
Well, that's the thing, Rondel said with a shrug. They can't really say we're fouling it up without anyone to compare us to.
And yet, I get the distinct impression that we're just on this side of utter failure,
Tyndall pointed out, speaking his true feelings for the first time.
If we're the first, or among the first, shouldn't we get a say in just what a knight mage is? What he does, what he doesn't do?
If you are attempting to institutionalise your way out of guard duty and other shit work, Ifnia's luck be with you, Rondel chuckled.
Not that I'm unsympathetic, mind you, but I don't see a way for us to avoid it.
Well, at least this part isn't so bad, Tyndall admitted, as they rode out of the village along the southern road. But all of that other stuff, the social obligations, the legal obligations, the arcane obligations, and all of it wrapped up with chivalry, which has precious little to do with magic. The mage lords of old didn't have to contend with chivalry.
And see what happened to them?
Really? I thought you, of all people, would be eager to don the mantle of chivalry, Rondel said, surprised. Most days you can't be pried out of the practice yard. If it was just fighting and swordplay, I'd be fine. Better, perhaps. But everything else? Well, it makes me wonder how knights have any fun.
Are we supposed to have fun?
Rondel countered.
I damn sure am, Tyndall said sullenly. I'm due some fun, without someone looking over my shoulder.
He looked at Rondel warily.
Why are you looking at me? Snorted the other apprentice. I'm not your bloody warden. Go bug a virgin goats if you'd like. I'll refrain from judgment, he said unconvincingly.
Tyndall snorted back.
What? You'd really not tell Master Min or Sire Kay if I, took some creative liberties with their carefully laid plans. You're your own idiot,
Rondel assured him. Then he paused a moment.
Why? What did you have in mind? Nothing felonious,
Tyndall assured him.
I think. I hadn't any particular crime in mind. I'm just proposing that we be open to adventure.
Rondel shrugged, which surprised Tyndall.
Isn't that the nature of errantry, supposedly?
So you just want to follow the road and see what kind of trouble you can get into?
We can get into,
Tyndall reminded him.
And I'm not saying we ignore our errand, merely that we enjoy it as much as we can. If that means risking a little trouble.
I just said I wouldn't tell and I wouldn't judge, Rondel said quickly. By all means, do what you please. I'm sure it will be instructive to watch. But, well, don't expect me to hold down the goat while you do it. As fortune favoured them, they had little in the way of adventure for the rest of that day as they rode south. They came to a prosperous manor late in the day and, for the first time, traded on their knighthood for a night of room and board. Despite Tyndall's dreams of luxury, the matron of the manor asked that he split some wood for the fire, as her servant had injured his shoulder. He did it with axe and maul, not magic, just to stretch muscles cramped by hours of riding. Rondol was tasked with bringing in water from the well, which he likewise did without revealing his arcane skills. Dinner was adequate, a hot stew of beans and chicken served on day-old trenchers. There was no cheese with their meal, but some butter that was not quite yet rancid. At supper they shared a table with the cream of the manor's ladyhood. None were younger than 30, and all seemed to have the sort of face that Sire Kay graciously called unfortunate. "So where are the dewy-eyed maidens?" Rondol teased his fellow apprentice. "I think they must be in the stew," grumbled Tyndall. "I'd figure there would be at least a maid or two about. This lot looks like a crone's wake." The next morning they thanked their hostess, received a stirrup cup after praising her hospitality, and accepted a modest lunch for the road, biscuits and the leftover stew from the night before. "So where is this first manor we're to find?" Tyndall asked, as they discovered the fare was better after a night's rest. "Raymoth's Wood? From what I understand, it is one of the estates belonging to the Lord of Lormere," Rondol supplied, "which you would know if you had listened to half of what our hostess said at dinner last night." "I was paying attention," protested Tyndall, annoyed. Rondol seemed to pick the most inane things to reprove him over. "I didn't ask who owned it. I asked where to find it." "Oh," Rondol said, taken aback. "It should be down this road, then west at the next crossroad. That will take us into Lormere, and Raymoth's Wood should be on the east side of the road. From what Sire Kay told me, the tenant lord is Sir Gammon the Red." "That is a foreboding-sounding name," admitted Tyndall. "So, any points of interest between here and Lormere?" "I think there's an inn at the next village," Ron answered. "But I think we really should be pursuing an errant's life of adventure?" Tyndall interrupted. "I couldn't agree more. All of this study, training, practice. Don't you want to use some of that great store of knowledge in the field?" he teased. Rondol looked uncomfortable, a common expression on the boy's face, but shrugged. "I suppose," he admitted, "but I don't want any trouble." "That's your problem," Tyndall said, shaking his head sadly. "You never want any trouble. Trouble gets people killed," Rondol pointed out, "and imprisoned, and fined, and captured, and experienced," he soothed. "That's why Sire Kay sent us out here. Seasoning. And if I do not feel the need to be seasoned, then you are working against your liege's orders," pronounced Tyndall. "Didn't Master Min say he wanted us to be independent and self-reliant?" "I thought his emphasis was more on training and instruction," Rondol said, as they clopped along. "This is training and instruction in self-reliance and independence," Tyndall rationalized. "It's just an inn. Two dashing young errants having an ale on the road. What could happen?" Rondol's groan was a pleasing sound in Tyndall's ear. It being market day, the inn was crowded and bustling with traffic when they arrived. The boys tied their horses and paid a lad an iron penny to watch them. They followed the trail of peasants and merchants within. The inn was called the Rampant Rabbit and featured a colourful sign over the door. A buffoonish, somewhat effeminate rabbit in a jousting helm and scarlet shirt, threatening a powerfully muscled bull with a limp carrot. Behind the rodent was a pretty lady rabbit, elegantly gowned, who seemed far more interested in the bull than her erstwhile protector. Tyndall found the sign highly entertaining, and wondered who had painted it. As busy as the trade was on a market day, their mantles and swords told them out as gentlemen, and that got them some attention quickly. Before long their host, Goodman Rogal, who seemed far too skinny to be a real innkeeper, ushered them to a good table near to the window, and soon ale and bread and game pies were put before them, along with a plate of the local cheese. "Now this is living properly," Tyndall said with a sigh, as he sipped the rich, nutty ale. "Far better than the last taverns. No pressures, no worries, just a couple of mates in an inn enjoying a meal.
This does seem to be the first time we've been without our masters and betters around in a while,
Rundle agreed, almost sounding enthusiastic about it. And this is truly excellent ale.
Strong, too, he said, sipping it slowly.
I sometimes wonder if this is truly all a man needs,
Tyndall said philosophically, as he looked around the friendly hall.
A woman's favour would be nice,
Rundle murmured, as he watched a trio of local village girls burst into the place. One of them might even be pretty, Tyndall decided with an expert eye, at least for another few years yet. They were not the type of maidens Tyndall found himself drawn to, but Rundle's attention had been captivated. Tyndall considered. He had no understanding of why his fellow apprentice resented him so. It was a mystery to Tyndall, but clearly there was still some secret issue between them. Perhaps, he reasoned, if he endeavoured to assist his comrade with one of his largest deficits, understanding the mysteries of femininity, then he would see that Tyndall was not inherently antagonistic. And if he failed, well, at least that would be entertaining. After what they had been through, he felt he at least owed Rundle the attempt at correcting his presentation when it came to girls. Although the lad was sullen, moody, and oftentimes cranky, he was still a fellow apprentice under the same master, and he was still Bovali. If Tyndall found him irritating and plodding, he had to admit that Rundle had never resorted to the sorts of bullying or underhanded behaviour that some apprentices had to fear from their fellows. In fact, most of the time Tyndall didn't mind Rundle's company at all, when he wasn't being aggressively sullen.
"What would you say if I told you how to seduce yon maiden that your eyes suddenly can't seem to leave alone?"
"What?" Rundle asked, struck out of his reverie.
"What? Who? Her? Me? What?"
"Let us begin with your appalling lack of eloquence," Tyndall said smoothly.
"Wait!"
Rundle sputtered.
"Why do I need your help to seduce her? And who said I wanted to seduce her at all? Perhaps the gentleman with the portly figure is more to your liking?"
suggested Tyndall.
"No, you idiot. I like girls plenty. And, yes, that one is fair,"
he admitted embarrassingly. "But I don't need your help to woo her."
"Then by all means, have at it,"
Tyndall approved, sipping his ale.
"Go ahead. I shall observe your stunning victory."
"Who said I wanted to pursue such a dalliance?"
demanded Rundle quietly. His eyes flashed angrily, and he held his drink in front of his lips protectively.
"Your eyes, for one, and the way you have your jaw clenched up, like you did around girls you like,"
he said, not able to mention that it was Astasia's presence that had brought the signal to his attention the first time.
"Then there's the uncomfortably awkward way you are shifting in your seat, as if you suddenly have a hot coal in your lap. But no, they are all liars. I'm sure you're just considering taking holy orders,"
he teased.
"That doesn't mean that we have the time, or—"
Rundle sputtered.
"I'm not saying marry the girl. She's twat, no, but she's almost comely, particularly when she's standing in such forgiving light and so near to her unfortunately faced friends. So, at least go get her name,"
Tyndall demanded.
"Put a word with the breasts and face, the memory of which you will be consoling yourself to sleep by tonight."
"It's not that simple,"
Rundle hissed, his eyes darting around.
"Boy,"
Tyndall said, gesturing toward Rundle with one long finger, before turning it on the maiden.
"Girl, it's really no more complicated than that. You cannot finish the hunt, you never start,"
he said, quoting from one of the many commentaries on Sire Rose's laws.
"So why do you have to learn how to hunt women like game?"
asked Rundle sourly.
"Because they don't just fall into your bed of their own accord,"
Tyndall countered, amused at his fellow's naivete.
"At least not usually, and rarely the worthy ones. They need to be persuaded, coaxed, charmed."
He grinned wolfishly.
"Pursued, hunted, but gently. Ever so gently."
"Lied to, you mean,"
Rundle accused. "That's all that Sire Rose is counselling, how to lie creatively to women."
"Not at all,"
Tyndall objected.
"That's a gross misstatement of the laws, and the hunt is a perfectly apt metaphor for the pursuit of love. He speaks of the many arrows in a man's quiver, each one a means to allure a maid's attention and keep it. Lying is rarely necessary, if a man knows the proper way to pursue a maid's heart,
Indeed, Sire Rose is merely instructing the young gentleman in how best to achieve no less than the noble aim of love.
Rondel snorted. His aim tends to be a bit lower than a lady's heart, I recall.
Oft has an impassioned embrace led to a lifetime of love, objected Tyndall.
And even more often a full belly or an unpleasant pox, Rondel grumbled.
We know the spells to ward against such things,
reminded Tyndall, who had shared them with his fellow as soon as he'd learned them.
You have the desire for a lady's favour in your heart, and no doubt for more intimacy than holding hands.
That doesn't mean I need to hunt down everything in a skirt.
You are not a child any more, Ron.
Why is this troubling you so? Tyndall asked.
Because love should happen naturally, as guided by Ishi's hands, Rondel said stubbornly.
It should not be practiced as a craft.
Tyndall sighed and studied his fellow determinedly. He had to alter his approach.
Craft? More art than craft. Attend. A man spends his life married to one woman, God's willing, Tyndall reasoned. In its way, it is a decision that affects his life as greatly as going to battle.
Or more.
Agreed?
Well, yes,
Rondel said sullenly, finishing his drink. Who one marries is, perhaps, as profound a decision for a man as picking up a sword.
And would it be wise to go into battle with no idea how to use a sword?
Challenged Tyndall.
No, he answered himself. A warrior trains. He practices. He learns how to use a sword, how to kill, how to defend himself. He learns how an enemy attacks and how he doesn't.
I'm familiar with the process, Ron said dryly.
Yet for a choice as important to a man as his fate in battle, you suggest he go into the affair without the slightest idea of how to conduct himself, what the rules of engagement and ordinances of propriety are. How can one expect a lady to respond? Why would you cripple yourself so with ignorance?
Rondel was silent for a while as the question hung in the air.
Love is supposed to be natural,
Rondel repeated. If a man weds for love, as the bride's sisters advise, then it is because Ishi's will has guided it thus, he said reverently.
A man need but be his natural self, and be of gentle demeanour, and he will enjoy many a long, lonely night, as celibate as a death sister, or married to a shrew of impressive quality, finished Tyndall, matter-of-factly.
How could his fellow apprentice be so stupid?
Really, Rondel? Do you really believe that Ishi decides who beds whom? Or do you think a maid decides herself?
Well, of course the maiden decides, Rondel snapped. It is always a lady's choice. And upon what merits does she decide to give her head or other parts to a man?
Why, on whatever merits she wishes,
Rondel snorted again. If she has a fancy for a man, and class and duty allow, then she may decide on whatever merit she likes.
That is Ishi's command.
Agreed, Tyndall smiled. The goddess had decreed that all free, unwed women enjoy the right to govern their favours as they alone saw fit, before they wed. Of course, if a maid enjoyed Ishi's blessing with every lad in town, there would likely not be a wedding. Many a bride's sister had succumbed to the allure of her own desires, and had been forced to take orders when no honest husband would support her.
And as Ishi wills, every woman will have her own personal preferences, will she not?
Of course, Rondel said, clearly annoyed with Tyndall's patronizing tone.
But when one examines the personal preferences of all women, or even of a number of women, would you not find some commonalities, some elements of a man's character and bearing that many, if not most, would find desirable?
Well, yes, Rondel said warily. A preference for men who are not ugly, deformed, infirm, cruel, mad, bound by law or sacred oath, or of low estate, would seem reasonable.
And lucky for you that you fulfil at least most of those requirements, Tyndall said sarcastically. But you can agree that there are some things that women, in general, prefer over others.
Height, for instance. Women enjoy a tall man.
It seems to be Ishi's design that you are taller than me, Rondel observed dryly,
and I have no means to correct her error.
Height is not one of my arrows.
So I am, Tyndall continued with a smile. But then you can wear boots, perhaps a hat.
It matters not how tall you are, really, as long as you are taller than the maiden. And your quiver is far from empty. You are strong. Women tend to value strength in a man, and courage, bravery, decisiveness.
Being fair of face, he grinned suddenly, certainly helps, and understanding how to speak intelligently to a lady is an asset. But there is one thing above all others that women desire when they see it in a man, and for it they will forgive much, if not all. A dazed expression and a purse the size of a pumpkin? I seem to have left those back home.
No, the expression is correct, but do not despair. Despite your lack of a boyishly fair face, muscles the size of chargers, or a purse the size of a pumpkin, even a man such as yourself may attract a woman of quality. Rondel, you merely lack confidence.
Rondel snorted.
You say that as if all I had to do was conjure it up. You don't, perhaps, have a spell for that, do you?
No, it's not magical in nature. It's merely a feeling, he said, pleased that his knowledge of blue magic allowed him to speak so confidently on the subject.
Confidence, you ass, is nothing more elaborate than the feeling of assuredness you have in the outcome of events. That is all.
It's more than... It can't be, Rondel faltered, as he considered the subject.
It is, Tyndall assured him. Nothing more. When you feel as if you know what is going to happen, you act confidently. When you are unsure of the outcome of events, you lack confidence. So if I bloody well know in advance that some lady will offer me nothing more than polite discussion about the weather, he said sourly,
that would work, agreed Tyndall.
I was joking.
I wasn't, Tyndall insisted.
That's my point. Ladies are attracted to men who act confidently. That is all. They care not why a man is confident, or in what he is confident, or in whom his confidence might rely. They merely sense that he is at ease because he is assured of the outcome in his own mind and acts accordingly.
What outcome? Whether or not a maid will bed you? One can hardly be assured of that, unless she's a whore, he amended.
The nature of the outcome is not at issue, Tyndall instructed, feeling pleased with himself. One must only be certain of some outcome. For instance, while I may not be assured of enjoying the favours of a particular lady, I can be assured that I will have a hot breakfast the next morning. I am utterly confident in it. Therefore, when I speak to a lady, I think not about the obstacles between me and Ishi's blessing, about which I am almost never assured, and dwell instead over the certainty of breakfast. With that pleasant thought in mind, I can proceed to discourse at length with a lady and appear utterly confident, which I am, he said, pleased with himself.
About breakfast, Rondel repeated dully.
That's your secret. It gives me confidence. That is just the largest arrow in the quiver of the paramour, Tyndall said airily. Another is jealousy.
Jealousy?
Indeed. A maid may have only a tepid interest in you if she spies you alone and lonely. You may only arouse a passing interest until another maiden declares her interest. Then the first lady suddenly sees you far, far more intriguing.
That indeed is true, Rondel admitted. It has never happened to me, of course, but I have witnessed it.
It could happen to you right now, should you wish.
Go speak to them, he urged.
Only speak not to the fairest one. Speak to the second fairest first. She will be flattered that a lord should begin to speak to her first, and your possible lady love will be far more receptive to your courting once she sees that interest.
Do you really think so?
Rondel asked doubtfully. And let us not forget our purse, position, and power, Tyndall continued, grinning. He enjoyed lecturing about a subject so dear to his heart. You are a lord, a man of means. She is a village girl, perhaps even a villein. A man of means is always more attractive than a pauper, and a man of high position always more attractive than a villein.
Obviously, dismissed Rondel.
And a gulf that purse will not bridge, position may.
That was a common saying back in Alshar.
Power is more alluring than either, Tyndall said, quoting Sire Rose again without attribution. A man with power needs neither position nor purse. He may have either at a word. Women flock to him like bees to honey. When you have it, you will see. Do you not see all of the doe-eyed maidens who follow our master since his ascension? Power may be relative,
but a little is often enough to encourage a kiss, or even hike a skirt.
I do have position,
Rondel pointed out.
You do,
Tyndall agreed. You are a knight and a mage lord, the agent of a rich and powerful man.
Use that,
he urged.
Is it a lie to say it?
No, Rondel agreed.
But you think your jests and cow eyes are going to convince her to hike her skirt, or even get her name of her own accord? Women are attracted to achievement and success. Concealing such things from them in the name of humility is a monk's game, not an errant's. It matters not how you impress her. You must merely impress her.
I would not have a woman like me only for my title or position, Rondel objected, or because she saw me as a rung on a ladder to higher position.
Such a woman would be unworthy to wed,
Tyndall agreed, but quite easy to bed, if you follow the laws of love, and perhaps even worth the trouble. But there is one more arrow you could loose at a maiden's heart, one easier than wealth, position, or power to manage.
Notoriety.
Reputation, you mean, Rondel corrected.
I chose the word carefully, Tyndall demurred.
Reputation may attract some women, but notoriety, whether for treason or triumph, a man whose name is on everyone's lips oft finds maidens of plenty on his own.
That, too, I will admit, Rondel agreed.
They had both seen just how potent notoriety had been during the coronation festivities in Castabriel and after the dragonfall in Barobel. One maiden after another had done whatever they could to attract their attention, and some of them had been very, very committed. Tyndall could recall his comrade faring poorly even then, due to his inexperience and unwillingness to act. Tyndall had been less cautious in enjoying the rewards of his notoriety. In Barobel in particular, he had indulged in dalliances with a number of ladies, noble and common. Lady Pentandra had encouraged and advised him, seeming amused by his enthusiasm, and he had faithfully followed her instruction. Indeed, much of what he was saying to Rondel, with such sagacity, he had heard first from Lady Pentandra, or read from books she'd recommended.
But no one here knows who I am or what I've done.
My notoriety is a broken arrow.
True,
Tyndall admitted, so one should take advantage of it when one can.
But, he added, you have many other things in your favour. Youth, vigour, position, bearing, and the sword helps,
he pointed out.
It does?
Rondel asked, surprised. Women enjoy the attention of dangerous men when they have a mind, Tyndall assured him. Some find it quite compelling. A man of arms can always find a maiden to comfort him willingly if he looks for her. In addition, you are a traveller, a stranger, an exotic foreigner with tales to tell and adventures to relate.
I suppose that is true,
Rondel conceded, eyeing the girl with a more hopeful expression.
See?
Tyndall encouraged. You have many arrows in your quiver. All you lack now is a bow.
How do I lack a bow?
Demanded Rondel.
Simple,
countered Tyndall. You have all the weapons you need, save the will to act.
Initiative.
You have to go talk to them, he emphasized. Your bow is your willingness to pursue a lady. He looked over at the peasant maiden.
Or a girl, he added.
So if I lose my position, my looks, my strength, my wit,
such as it is,
Tyndall interrupted. Rondel ignored him. The fact that I am a stranger, and the fact that I am a warrior, all of those will be enough to woo her, if I have but the will to pursue the affair with the zeal of a hunter pursuing a wounded hart, he concluded, skeptically.
I count your chances far better than dancing with that mug and staring at her all day,
Tyndall observed. But there is one more thing you must understand about the esoteric nature of Ishi's blessing.
Instruct me, O sagacious master,
Rondel mocked.
It is actually quite profound,
Tyndall murmured, looking around as if he feared being overheard. Once you first understand the nature of a woman's cycles...
Oh, Trigg's hairy armpit,
objected Rondel.
Is there nothing you hold sacred in your quest for girls?
Listen, insisted Tyndall, seriously. A woman's cycle is the key to her heart, or at least to her skirts. You know of a woman's monthly courses?
Yes,
affirmed Rondel, uncomfortably.
Well, near to 2 weeks prior or after, a woman's desires are most inflammable to a man who understands the mystery.
It's as if she becomes warm. She bares her neck sometimes, or wears more revealing gowns. So Lady Pentandra assures me, he added, to lend credibility to his statement. A woman will be far more intrigued with feats of arms or displays of largesse during this critical moment. More, she is oft so moved by her desires that her resistance to a thoughtful persuasion is lowest. Pentandra also says that this is a woman's best time to conceive a child. Rondel groaned. Of course, it would be. The gods have a nasty sense of humour. You're not the first to note that. So I should quietly inquire as to when their monthlies last came, before I decide to pitch my woo? Asked Rondel, amused. Another round, he called to the innkeeper, who nodded happily. I would advise against it, Tyndall insisted. You have to guess, based on her state and demeanour. Something else to amuse the gods, I suppose. But even then, you can begin to track her heart. If you know the other mystery. And that is simple. Ishi has ordained that the path to a woman's heart, and between her legs, lies in her reactive nature. Reactive nature? Rondel asked, confused. A woman's desire is reactive in nature, explained Tyndall, both in the words of the ancients and in my experience. Perhaps one in three, one in four, will be more aggressive, he chuckled, or lack desire entirely. But the other three or four may require something to react to engage their desires. What precisely do you mean? Asked Rondel warily. Women require a man to be provocative before they feel able to surrender their hearts to a man, Tyndall said, as if he was relaying the deepest secrets of magic. They need a man to be strong, take a stand, and take the initiative before they can decide whether or not they will follow. You sound like a madman, snorted Rondel. Honestly, Tin, women do not merely respond. They take plenty of initiative. In affairs of the heart, forget for a moment those ladies in Castabriel who wanted to bed us to get closer to Master Min, and the noble maidens of Barabel whose hearts were inflamed by our victory over the dragon. When a man and a woman entertain to spark, the woman tends to react to what the man does, not the other way around. Not if he's smart, he added ruefully. That's rubbish, snorted Rondel, as the innkeeper set down two more mugs. Have you ever waited for a girl to kiss you? Tyndall challenged. Have you been alone with her? The moment seemed right, and you looked at her and waited for her to do something, and she didn't? Well, yes, Rondel admitted quietly. I always thought it was just because they didn't really want to be with me. Idiot! Tyndall snorted in return. She was waiting for you to take the initiative, for you to loose your arrow, so to speak. Because you didn't hazard an action, she was not therefore in a place in which she could naturally respond. What if she's not really excited about being with you? Rondel countered. What if she really does just prefer your company as a brother? Then the taint of your rejection will lie on your brow like a sigil for all to see, predicted Tyndall dramatically. Everyone will know what a craven buffoon you are. At worst, she will slap you, Tyndall continued, less sarcastically. As long as she is not above you in station, or particularly naive, she will forgive the attempt, if it was sincerely made and properly executed. If not, well, there are worse reputations to gather than that of a lad who likes to kiss, he offered. Are you gentlemen perhaps referring to the maidens? Asked the innkeeper, who had chanced to linger after delivering the drinks. Maidens in general, Tyndall replied, but they were the ones to inspire our discourse. I'd advise against it, warned the innkeeper. Folly is filthy. Casa is like to drag you to a bride sister after getting you drunk, and Dindra, well, she's a fair one and agreeable, but a bit too agreeable, if you take my meaning. Your candour is appreciated, nodded Tyndall with a smirk. He'd figured as much. But Rondel had to start somewhere. We weren't seriously considering paying court, just admiring their form. We seek the Lord of the Domain, one Sir Gammon, with whom we have business. Sir Gammon? Asked the innkeeper in surprise. Then you'll be better off passing up these common skirts. Lady Crestine is as fair a lady as one could hope to see. Sir Gammon's wife? Aye, the man said, pleased to be able to share the local gossip.
In Tyndall's experience, innkeepers and stable boys knew more than captains and commanders. She's a fair one, as is their daughter, Lady Thena. If you are considering paying court, she would be a better prospect than these, he said, gesturing toward the giggling girls disdainfully. And where might we find Sir Gammon's manor? Raymoth Wood. Take the west road a half mile and then turn north. You'll see the gate, the sign of a hare on a field of white, under a scarlet chevron. A rabbit, snorted Tyndall. Hardly a beast to inspire terror in the hearts of one's enemies. Sir Gammon inherited the device from his forebears, recounted the innkeeper. Nice enough folk, I suppose, but...
But what?
Asked Rundle, curious. The innkeeper shook his head. 'Tis not wise to talk idly about your betters. If you have business with my lord, then you gentlemen can make your own judgments. Tyndall was about to ask for details, when an ear-splitting call from the upper room cut through the chatter.
Aston! It called, hoarsely and viciously. Aston, get up here! I need you to bring more hot water!
The innkeeper closed his eyes as if he'd borne a bad blow. That's the other reason why you need to avoid the village girls, he sighed. I had my head turned by a pretty ankle and a shy smile once. When you do go to court a maid, he said with sudden intensity, by all the gods, choose wisely.
Aston! Repeated the call.
The innkeeper sighed again and went to fetch a kettle of water from the fire. Tyndall glanced back at the village girls, who were starting to take more notice of Rondell's attention. He could suddenly imagine all of them aged, worn, and rotund after years of comfortable marriage. He suppressed a shudder. He supposed that sort of thing was all right for some, but he was a man of action. No common woman would lure him from a life of adventure. Let's go, he said quietly, as he dug for his purse and drank the last of his ale. I'm suddenly anxious to go lay eyes on this high-born lady.